So with that big data set, Tom, it sounds like you'll be able to answer this question we've been wondering. Between Virginia and Newfoundland, who is the worst archaeologist?
Oh, I keep my opinions to myself. I might have opinions about it.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in Manchester, New Hampshire, and I'm joined, as I am just about every fortnight, by Ken Holyoke, who appears to be in the studio on the longest hallway in North America. Is that right, Ken?
That is correct. It is getting to be a pretty quiet hallway, actually, because we're nearing the end of the semester here at the University of Lethbridge.
That's great. So are your grades in?
One of the classes, the grades have been submitted today, and then the other one probably be by Thursday. So.
Okay, well, that's an exciting feeling. And the listener can't see this, of course, because we're an audio podcast, but Ken is wearing what our mutual friend Evan calls a fun guy shirt. He's wearing it's not really an Aloha shirt, but it's a shirt that says... I'm a father of two, and I'm letting what's left of my hair down because I'm not working right now.
Exactly. Yeah. And underneath, actually, is the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast T-shirt, which
excellent,
which gets some play. And I'm happy to say that Emmanuel, I ran into him at the gym a couple weeks ago, and Emmanuel is always showing the podcast off when he's at the gym, which is we need to get that man another couple T-shirts, I think.
That's great. I mean, we could probably get him the ones. I believe, Ken, you were saying that the ones you ordered for the podcast, presumably for us, not for Emmanuel, were the dad bod cut.
Yeah. I think Emmanuel doesn't need that cut.
No, exactly.
The ones that hide the belly. I
assume he's ripped the sleeves off as well.
No, it's all intact but great to see the logo out there.
Okay, well that's great. And so Ken, would you like to go through a list of people who have declined to sponsor us in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, we have a growing list of rejection letters for sponsorship of the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, but we do currently have a sponsor, and that is the University of New Brunswick's Grand Lake Meadows Fund. Is that
That's
not correct?
Right. Yes, I believe they are paying for this and maybe the next couple of episodes or the last episode and maybe the few upcoming ones.
Yeah. So we're flying on the what's the saying? Walking on broken glass.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think our shirk record may be kind of impressive. Like we are over. So, Ken, even though we've been having some hard time securing external support, soft money for this program, we're still flush enough that we've got some great programs for if there were to be a listener to rename this podcast. And that's, Ken, I think, as you know, our producer, Emmanuel, has been suggesting that we could actually still be in growth mode. I think, Ken, we start to lean towards complacency. Would you say that's right?
I think that... It wasn't so much complacency as, I think it was, we didn't see the growth that Emmanuel saw in us.
Oh, that's a good way to put it. Yes. He's not just a producer. He's a motivational speaker, really.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Precisely. And so, Ken, we're currently called the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, but one of the ways we could potentially realize growth would be to rename this podcast in such a way that when people were searching around for other things, they would find this podcast. You know what I mean?
Yep, I agree. Yep.
And
search engine optimization we talk about a lot?
Yes. I believe we're all in on SEO here.
Yeah.
And so
we're not.
That's right. Yeah. And so but what we would do, because we want to respect the listeners we already have, you know, the current listeners are precious to us. If they sent in a new name for this podcast, we would make sure they were richly rewarded. Is that right?
That's correct.
And if they were to want to give us their IP, where would they send it?
Send that new title to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled archaeology, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. And if we were to open that mailbag in a couple of weeks and see a winning name, here's what the listener would be in for. And so, Ken, is it springtime there in Alberta from your shirt? I'm getting the impression it is.
It is lovely. It's going to be 20 degrees this afternoon.
Okay. Well, that's lovely. And Ken, if you're like me, that's good news. And that's because, as Bartlett Giamatti wrote, the game begins in the spring when everything else begins again, and it blossoms in the summer, filling the afternoons and evenings, and then as soon as the chill rains come, it stops and leaves you to face the fall alone. You count on it, rely on it, to buffer the passage of time, to keep the memory of sunshine and high skies alive, and just then when the days are all twilight, when you need it most, it stops, and that game, of course, is baseball. I don't think it's any mystery to the listener that I'm a fan of baseball, and in particular, I'm partial to the college game, and that's not just because the Curlin Job Institute has refused to sponsor us to promote quality Tommy John surgery at a reasonable rate, and the Ghost Runner in extra innings was sent by Satan to test our faith. It's because I think the approachability of play at that level, players who are good but not superhuman, the tendency of the ball to actually be in play, the pace of the game, and the persistence of finesse rather than power pitching, and myriad other factors just make it incredibly enjoyable. And Ken, that's why I'm excited to let the listener have this great opportunity to attend the MLID RTK GNSS-sponsored College Baseball Classic. And Ken, could you tell us what it is that the MLID company is known for?
They're known for inexpensive, high-quality RTK and GNSS systems. So like high-quality, high-accuracy GPSs at a bargain price.
That's right. And Ken, you might not think initially that that's an intuitive sponsor for a college baseball classic. And the listener may be thinking that doesn't exactly sound like the NCAA, and that's true. And here's the catch. MLID Classic teams share one thing, and that's their names make knowing where their home stadiums are nearly impossible. So let me give you an example here, Ken. The Indiana University of Pennsylvania. Go Crimson Hawks. But there are others. The University of the Rio Grande is, unfortunately for Red Storm and surprisingly for many of us, in Ohio. In the MLID Baseball Classic, you might see them face off against Miami University, also in Ohio, and the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine in Georgia, or Washington University in St. Louis. But here's the catch. Are you familiar, Ken, with geocaching?
I am,
yeah. That's right, the outdoor recreational phenomenon where the participants use a GPS to find containers all around the world and sign the logbook contained within. That's right, Ken. The stadiums for each series in the MLID Baseball Classic are arranged as geocaches in the surprising communities that some of these schools are located in. So let's say Transylvania University is playing a home game against Manhattan Christian College. Not only will the Manhattan Christian team have to get from their campus, which as everyone knows is in Kansas, they'll be provided with GPS coordinates to the Transylvania Stadium, which is in Kentucky. And now let's say the Manhattan Thunder dropped 2 out of 3 to the Pioneers. They're back on the bus to Kansas, and Transylvania is presented with a new set of coordinates to find their way to the Lake Erie College of Medicine in Bradenton, Florida. And I should say, Ken, that the quality of play is very high. We're seeing some great pitching out of the PCOM group in Georgia, and of course Santa Fe College in beautiful Gainesville always brings the bats. And look, Ken, I just want to address one thing here that I know the listener's thinking. I know a lot of listeners are wondering why California University, which was in Western Pennsylvania, isn't eligible this year. And Ken, I just highlight this because I think it shows the integrity of the folks over at the MLID Baseball Classic, and I don't mind saying that it's true. 2 years ago, the Cal University bullpen was in fact caught installing MLID base stations in the stands at other universities. And the rules are pretty clear about this. RTK corrections to improve your speed between parks is strictly prohibited. And so not only was Cal U stripped of its title, it's also been forced to be renamed as Penn West University. And listener, you may be wondering how we're going to get you to these games. Because, of course, it's somewhat complicated. Well, listener, we've arranged a seat for you and 4 friends in a gently used and fully refurbished CH-147F Chinook helicopter. There, you along with the pilot will receive the coordinates to the stadiums and be choppered rapidly among the fields so you won't miss a minute of geographically bewildering baseball action. So that's right, listener, grab your peanuts, your Cracker Jacks, and a GNSS-equipped GPS and let MLID and the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast take you out to the ballgame. And Ken, where would the lucky listener send his or her new name for this, yes, this award-winning podcast?
Well, they would send that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. They would dial in those coordinates, New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, and they would have to plug in archaeology spelled A-R-C-H-A-E-O-L-O-G-Y, and then they would set their sights on newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. And Ken, if you reach into that mailbag, what is in store for us this fortnight?
Well, we do have a couple of mail items in here.
Okay.
So, from Tammy, the podcast, the title is Love the Program and a Reminiscence. And so it says, Hi, Ken and Gabe, longtime listener, first time caller. I found your podcast a year a year or so ago because I was reminiscing about a summer I spent in New Brunswick in the late 1970s.
Oh.
My parents had grown up there before moving to Marietta, Ohio, where I live now.
I'm sorry,
Danny. My then boyfriend and I decided to take a road trip to visit my aunt and uncle who had a farm in Burt's Corner. Oh, that's my neck of the woods.
So wait, Ken, she said Marietta, Ohio?
Correct.
That's actually the best town in Ohio.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's got a series of interesting woodland period mounds.
Oh, well, maybe that's what we're going to be talking about here.
Including one that a Christian cemetery has been built around.
Is this where the Pathway to the Stars Hopewell mounds are? Is that Marietta?
I don't think so.
There's like a series of geometric Hopewell mounds that like map onto where the Milky Way is on the summer solstice.
Oh, interesting. I had not dropped acid when I was there, so it's possible I missed that.
All right, so Tammy goes on. The drive from Marietta takes 2 or 3 days, and one of my... Marietta to Burt's Corner only takes 2 or 3 days. Oh, that's actually less time than I would have thought. And one of my memories of that trip
like Fredericton to Burt's Corner takes 2 or 3 days.
Depends on which road you take. One of my memories of that trip is that by somewhere in Connecticut, I was interested in finding a replacement boyfriend. There was, unfortunately, no New Brunswick Archaeology podcast to listen to on the drive. We could have talked less. Oh, poor guy.
Well, I mean, or maybe poor Tammy. It sounds like a terrible trip.
Yeah, it does sound like poor Tammy. So to make a long story short, I spent a fair portion of my summer with 2 boyfriends and returned to Ohio with 0 boyfriends. Oh, no. This is a great email. Ironically, even though Marietta has a lot of archaeology, I was naive about archaeology in general, and needless to say, was surprised to learn that my auxiliary gentleman was working on an archaeological survey. We didn't stay in touch, but the experience did inspire me to spend part of the 80s and 90s working seasonally in CRM down here before shifting into HR, so I'm guessing... Not heritage resources, I'm guessing human resources. For universities and even a few CRM firms. In some ways, my summer in NB
also,
was ideal preparation.
Can I just say that working HR for a few American CRM firms, I bet, send us an email about that, Tammy.
Well, she says that my summer in NB was ideal preparation. So I was looking for podcasts about New Brunswick while feeling nostalgic after my weekly paint and sip. Ken's voice instantly transported me back to that time. It's my new bi-weekly, I mean fortnightly, tradition to sit on my sun porch in the evening with a very large martini or two and travel through time with you in more ways than one. Best wishes, Tammy. Well, Tammy, that is
lovely,
awesome.
Tammy,
that's like
you.
That is great to hear. And we'll maybe we should do a we should figure out what the actual like archaeological stuff is in Marietta and do great sites. Somebody who works in Marietta.
That's a great idea, actually.
Now that we're in the Ohio heartland. So Tammy, you live in an incredibly fascinating archaeological area.
It's true.
Sort of the Ohio, so Hopewell and Edina heartland.
That's true. It's a great place to get a pepperoni roll and drive around and look at the sights.
Yeah. So I've never been to Ohio, actually. So that... anyway, Tammy, thank you for writing in, and we'll give you a write back. But if you're listening, send us your address, and we'd love to send you some stickers
in the mail. Yeah,
in the mail. Yeah. So thank you, Tammy.
So who was the boyfriend working archaeology in the late 70s? I wonder. There might be a listener out there who's very nervous right now.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe she's got a connection to some of the. Maybe she'll recognize a name that we've dropped at some point in the podcast as she's getting through episodes.
Yeah, and so. Just remember, Tammy, democracy dies in darkness, so feel free to let us know more gossip.
Okay, so the next one here that we have is, I thought that, so it's particularly appropriate, this is spam, but I thought it was particularly appropriate spam considering that we're going to be traveling across the ocean to Norway. In this spam email, it's in Swedish, it says your protection has ended and now you need to take action to avoid danger. I put it into Google Translate, but it says the title of the email is Dit skid har loppt ut agera nu for at undvika farar.
I don't know what that is, but I would want a strong antibiotic if my protection to that had ended.
I think I'll be deleting that email before I even open it. And then our final piece of the mailbag comes from Katrina. And she says, "Hey guys, just catching up on episodes while sewing my little heart out."
This is as Katrina who just called in live earlier.
Yeah, it is Katrina who just called in live. Yeah. And as I was nearing the quarter end of the December 4th episode, I heard Gabe mention customized robes. I know Christmas is over, but you certainly piqued my interest. Auntie Cat's Stitchery, and that's Katrina's dressmaking and other stitching business, is willing to make you two reigning champs a couple of custom robes for a small fee, of course. I think I have it in my head that we were talking about, Katrina and I were texting about this the other night. I think it had something to do, we were talking about boxing, I think.
Okay.
And so she says, for a small fee, of course, if you're interested, I would need some details, colors, sizes, patterns for trim, and exactly which names you would like to have embossed on the back. Sounds like a fun project and would certainly be fun to see worn at an event in the future. Yours truly, Auntie Cat.
So, Auntie Cat, I think we are actually probably quite. I don't want to. I don't have children, so I can speak more easily for my finances than Ken can. But the I think we are interested, aren't we, Ken?
I think that would be a load of fun, actually. Yeah. And I think some boxing robes to wear.
Yeah, and I think it's Lebowski night at the next ESAP.
Yeah, that would be. I think that would be very appropriate. So Katrina, we'll take this offline and figure out what information you need and what the fees are going to be associated with this.
I've been carried out of a Canadian-American Friendship Party, but I've never been kicked out of one. And so
we're going to have to get licensed to play the Rocky music, I think.
Absolutely.
If we do get them.
Yeah. And maybe find some stairwells to run up and down.
Yeah, maybe Emmanuel can compose us some kind of like re-envisioning of the Rocky music, and then we could use the music in the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ken, will you follow up with Katrina and let her know that we are in fact interested? I mean, just because I know she's a few months behind on listening here.
yeah. Well, this is a new email. This is when she's just catching up on episodes. So I think she's back in the stitchery and listens to us on heavy rotation.
Oh, excellent. Well, we'll let her know. We would love that. Thank you very much, Katrina. And we're looking forward to doing business with you. Does she have a website or something we can plug or?
She's got a Facebook page, and let me pull that up here if you can kind of
cool, yeah.
Do a little stall. Maybe you introduce what the episode's about, and I'll pull this up.
So we, as the listener knows, we've been doing human-environmental interactions all season. And as part of that, we got in touch with a fellow named Thomas Royal, who is working on the 4 Oceans Project. That's the number 4-Oceans. And what he's doing is taking these big zooarchaeological data sets and doing analyses basically that kind of link climate change and past fisheries. And it's really interesting because he's considering these huge data sets over fairly big space here in the Northeast.
Yeah, very cool. And so very interesting interview. And just to get back to the mailbag here before we wrap up, so Auntie Cat's Stitchery can be found on Facebook, and that's facebook.com/hauntycat, capital H-A-U-N-T-Y, capital K-A-T, Auntie Cat. And if you search it, Auntie Cat's, and cat is K-A-T-S, Stitchery, and you'll find Katrina's site on there.
And probably you'll find pictures of us sitting around in robes to help promote the
Exactly. And you can always find us on the internet. So we're on Instagram. And so that's instagram.com/new_Brunswick_archaeology. Archaeology spelled A-R-C-H-A-E-O-L-O-G-Y.
All one word.
I believe if you search @new_Brunswick_archaeology, you can also find us. And you can find us, you can send us an email, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. And find us just on our website, newbrunswickarchaeology.com.
And for the MBA types, we have a LinkedIn too, don't we?
We don't have a LinkedIn dedicated to the podcast, but we have our own LinkedIn where we post that information. And mine is...
Oh, yeah. And by we mean Ken posts that information, I guess, on his LinkedIn. That must be how that works.
Yes.
That's why I see that.
So linkedin.com/Kenneth-Holyoke. And so you can find me on LinkedIn. I guess we should maybe create a podcast LinkedIn.
We possibly should, yes. We'll wait till we have pictures of us in robes.
Exactly. Yeah. We're hiring.
Yeah. If she puts a long enough hood on it, we can use it for graduation too.
Oh yeah, that could that would make a very good academic robe.
There we go. Yeah.
All right, listener. So we're gonna flip this over to an interview. We're gonna head across. Well, we're still where we are. Yeah. But Thomas, we're gonna talk to Thomas across the ocean.
We don't know if Thomas is still where he is.
That's true. This was, man, we're gonna be dropping back through time. Although I think it is a timeless interview.
It is.
Yeah. But yes. Yeah.
And we don't want to destroy trip. We really do think the listener will enjoy it, and Thomas keeps it fairly accessible despite being a pretty arcane topic.
Yes, yeah, and feedback on this as well. We're more than happy to hear from you afterwards. Write in, send us a message on Instagram. We love hearing from you, listener, and we'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon, listener. Today we're joined by Dr. Tom Royal, who's a postdoc at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, where he's affiliated with the Four Oceans Project. He has a BA in archaeology from Trent and an MA and PhD in archaeology from Simon Fraser. He has a number of recent publications in such journals as Human Ecology, Ecology and Evolution, and Plus One. He's joining us today to discuss his research on using archaeological data to understand the relationship among humans, fish, and the environment using archaeological data from North America. In particular, he is working to understand the deep history of the resource management and fishing strategies used by indigenous people in northwestern and northeastern North America. So thanks very much for joining us, Tom.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
And so I thought maybe we could just start off, Tom, to set the stage for our discussion. You're a postdoc with the European Research Council, and you're working on the Four Oceans Initiative. And so what is the Four Oceans Initiative?
So the Four Oceans Project Initiative, it's a European Research Council synergy project that is a partnership between the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, Trinity College Dublin, and Nova University in Lisbon, that seeks to assess the importance of marine life for human societies during the last two millennia, so around from AD 1 to the industrialization of fishing at the end of the 20th century under steam power. And the goal of the project is sort of to understand the global history, so both across the world, how people were exploiting fish and the effects of human activities on fish populations, as well as populations of other aquatic critters, such as walruses and dugongs. So to gain this understanding, the project is an interdisciplinary team that includes experts in historical archaeology, marine environmental history, climate history, natural history, geography, historical ecology, ancient DNA, radiocarbon dating, and isotopic analysis. And by harmonizing and using this interdisciplinary approach, we're really trying to hopefully get a more holistic understanding of the past 2,000 years of relationships between humans and the ocean and marine life.
Cool. Wow. And I'm guessing that's particularly important right now because obviously with the collapse of some recent fisheries around the world and also trying to have sustainable fisheries, is that sort of how some of this work contributes?
Yeah, that's part of it. We're trying to sort of learn from the past to inform the future. So a lot of research is, for example, trying to explore what caused declines in the past, so we have insights into activities that might cause declines in the future, or how past climatic change that is analogous to the warming that we're currently experiencing, how that in the past has affected marine life. For example, the medieval warm period during the early Middle Ages, that was a warm spell, a global warm spell that saw an increase in atmospheric and sea surface temperatures. And by learning how marine life, so fish, whales, and other animals responded to this past warming, we can predict how they're going to respond to future warming.
Cool.
See how the intensification of fishing, how that impacted wildlife, how we can sort of use that to inform our understanding.
Does these kind of data also give you a sense of like baseline? So, is it robust enough that you can kind of figure out like fish stock at that time, or is it there's like kind of some gentle interpretation when it comes to stuff like that?
Part of it has been looking at sort of the trying to establish baselines before human impact, so we know exactly how much population, how much populations have been affected by human activities. So for example, one of our colleagues at Oslo was looking at sort of the persistence of herring stocks. So do the herring stocks we observe today, were they the same genetically in the past, or has there been, as a result of overfishing, that the regional herring stocks have changed? And other colleagues are doing similar approaches for walruses in the Canadian Arctic, sort of looking at regional morphology to see what the past populations existed, morphologically distinct and genetically distinct populations existed, and how overhunting has shifted those up. So how can we, using archaeology, to get this information of what the ecosystem looked like before it was impacted.
Interesting. So you're joining us today. I commented before we started talking. The listener can't see this, but there's looks like a beautiful landscape outside your window. You're joining us from Norway, but your contribution in this project, and we're kind of interested about this, is you're using some data sets from Eastern North America, and so you're leading kind of a sub-project under this Four Oceans Initiative that uses legacies or archaeological data sets to consider occurrence and abundance of fish taxa that existed during the late Holocene on sites in northeastern North America. And so kind of simplifying that, you're looking at a bunch of different fish species in a series of sites from probably around 5,000 or so years ago onwards. Would that be fair?
Yeah, so what we're doing is we're gathering, the occurrence of fish species, what fish species are occurring at sites, and how frequent or their abundance, how many individual bones of each species occurs. And yes, we're looking at sort of Eastern North America, which we're sort of defining as from Newfoundland and Labrador and the northern Quebec in the north, down to Virginia in the south, the Chesapeake in the south. And we're sort of looking from the beginning of the woodland period and ceramic period about 5,000 years ago up to our latest data sets are the early 20th century.
Very cool.
So trying to get this big expanse of fish use among both indigenous and settler communities across this wide, broad region.
It's like a massive data set so far. So like almost 200,000 fish bones, 600 archaeological sites. What are the goals of this research project? And sort of what's the advantage of using archaeological data sets? It kind of sounds probably mirrors sort of what you guys are doing more broadly in the Four Oceans Initiative.
So what we're trying to do with the fish data, by looking at this broad approach, is by applying methods from data science, we can sort of tease apart get a sense of how fisheries and fish use across this wide region of Eastern North America were varying across space and time. So for example, by comparing different regions, for example, the Maritimes versus New York State, was there one regional fishing tradition among woodland people in Eastern North America during indigenous peoples during the woodland period? Or was there regional traditions that were informed by local traditional ecological knowledge? And also looking across time, get a sense of how do indigenous and settler fisheries differ and how are they similar? Were they harvesting the same taxa, or did colonization represent a break in the local fishing traditions that represented a rapid refocusing or reshifting of fishing practices that could have had impacts on the ecosystem? And by also mapping sort of the abundance of different species across time and across space, we can sort of get a sense that ecological changes. For example, some fish are very adapted to very specific salinity gradients. So if we get a shift in sort of some of these estuarine areas, there is a disappearance of high salinity fish and replacement with more freshwater brackish fish, that there might have been changes in saltwater, salt concentration, saltwater levels, dependent on environmental conditions like what we know that today affect levels of salt and salinity, such as increased temperatures and drought. And yes, once again, sort of get a sense of how these past climatic events, like the medieval warm period or the Little Ice Age, affected local fish populations.
Interesting. And so, as Kent mentioned, you've got this huge data set, and you said that sort of organizing it involves some tools from data science. And so I'm guessing that you're doing something beyond the Excel sheet here. And so could you kind of outline a little bit of what some of the challenges of using these legacy data, you know, that are reported by all sorts of different people in different ways, and then what are some of those tools from data science that you're applying to them?
Yeah, so we do actually start out with an Excel sheet, so that's what one of the databases is the old classic Excel sheet with numbers and names. And the Excel sheet's the start off for everything. But within that Excel sheet, we're logging, yes, for each assemblage and site, sort of the dates that each site was occupied, a cultural affiliation, if one's available. So for example, and at the basic level, whether a site is indigenous or a settler site, and site type. So we do work with an Excel sheet with these numbers of lists of species and presence. For more of the data science stuff, a lot of it is the downstream processing. So using a lot of packages in R and stuff to model abundance over time. So for example, to look at changes in, by using the abundance and number of identified specimens and assemblages, and if we have their dates of that assemblage known, we can plug into a program and we run a bunch of simulations, and it can sort of model how abundance over time and model how the fish abundance peaked at a certain time and fell off. But there is a lot of challenges with the research. So zoo archaeology, like archaeology as a whole, is an evolving discipline, and there's been a lot of changes in the past 50 years, or the especially since the emergence of processual archaeology. One of the big differences is that what we refer to species by has been changing, especially as a result of the genetic revolutions in the 1980s and modern molecular ecology and molecular phylogeny. So what someone in the 80s referred to as, for example, a certain type of catfish might as belonging to this family of catfish might now actually be recognized as two different families of catfish. So for example, in the past, bullheads, amureus, and channel cats were one members of the same genus, but they have since been split off into two genuses. So what people are using, the names have changed, so that requires sort of trying to go through this list of names, a couple hundred names, and harmonizing them to one unified taxonomy. The other issue is zoo archaeologists at the beginning weren't using scientific names, so sometimes they have to guess at what they're referring to. So when they're referring to something as a cod, is it an Atlantic cod, the big cod, or is it just referring to the cod family? Same things with like herring and sardines. They can refer to multiple fish. Like, other like challenges Gaspero have been
and alewife, and there's like a couple other names, I think, depending upon where.
Yeah, there's like alewife for alewife. Shad, is that the other? Yeah, shad. Yeah. Blueback.
I'm guessing also your lab group, when you guys go out to dinner together, you're all very fun when you're getting details from the waiter about the exact species that you're ordering. And
yeah, the exact species. Yeah. Trying to get all the details possible. You know, I know some people that if they get a whole cooked fish, will take the skeleton for the reference collection if they're going to
die. Oh, really? Before they
That's awesome. Eat it. Yes. Yeah, so yeah, I've definitely had dinner. I've had dinner with that a couple times with people. But yeah, so some of the challenges is, yeah, rectifying, trying to get all the taxonomy to make like apples, comparing apples with apples instead of oranges and apples. The other issue is how zoo archaeologists have been recording the data. So for every zoo archaeologist, there is a new quantitative measure of how to best measure the abundance of species in an assemblage. So for some people, we just record the number of identified specimens. So how many specimens, how many individual bones belong to each species? Some people try to calculate the minimum number of individuals, so not how many bones of each species are represented, but by how many individuals are represented within an assemblage. Or other people try to identify how much meat a single bone represents and then try to calculate that for the entire assemblage. So for this project, we've been focusing on the number of identified specimens, just because it's the easiest quantitatively to deal with and statistically, and a lot of other things like minimum number of individuals is predicted by number of individual specimens. So that's been a lot of a difficulty too, is trying to get collect data that's all comparable.
Yeah, yeah. So like for the listener, number of identifiable specimens, or NISP, is basically just a piece count of every bone that is recovered at a site. And then minimum number of individuals, or MNI, is basically you're interpreting from particular bone elements. Like, you know, a fish doesn't have more than one skull, right? So each skull represents a fish, but you could have a bunch of rib bones, right? Or something like that. And so you have to kind of figure out the threshold if you have a bunch of ribs to which, how many fish you might have. Is that
it? Yeah, you're trying to infer how many individuals these bones represent. At least.
And so how do you grapple with, for example, at a bigger scale, representatives, like, so you'll have a really, the data set will kind of be really robust in some areas and very, and so like I work in the interior of New Brunswick. So I'm guessing you probably get about 15 fish elements, you know, or fish specimens, yeah, from interior of New Brunswick, basically, right? But you probably have a ton of them from, like, the Passamaquoddy Bay area or so. So how do you, like, how does the modeling accommodate that? Or is it you're not trying to kind of correct for those sort of things? You're just look, like, where there is abundance, you're looking at that relative to what there is today.
Yeah, so we're not correcting for regional differences. We're just accepting that there is sampling differences between regions that we will never be able to correct, because that's the data that exists. And there is, you in the data set, there definitely is regional biases. So a lot of it has to do where universities had their field school, or where there's been a long tradition of archaeology of certain periods.
Where they use screens.
Yeah. Or an archaeologist that's really into particular fish, or yeah, like Gabe's saying, like, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, screens, yeah, yeah, yeah. So we do try to correct for things such as recovering methods, because we know, yeah, for example, screens do improve the recovery of fish bone because they're really small. A lot of fish bones are really small, so if you're just hand-picking them out of the soil, you'll especially miss a lot of small fish. So in the database, we are recording whether something is screened or hand-recovered, just so we can correct for that and examine the effect of recovery methods. But yeah, there's still always biases. So yeah, you can definitely see, for example, Virginia has a lot of sites, Virginia and Maryland have a lot of sites from the historic period, just because it was an early area of English settlement. So there's a ton of people that work in that area. Money and research attention goes there. So we have a large data set for there. Newfoundland, we have a surprisingly large number of sites, just because Memorial has been very active there for a very long time. And yeah, and Quaddy, there's from the work there. And, you know, so you get these regional differences. But yeah, it's hard to correct for them. It's just something we have to accept. And it's the, for the modeling, yeah, it's not really taking account for that. We're just learning as we go and seeing what comes out, and doing the best we can with what data we have.
So with that big data set, Tom, it sounds like you'll be able to answer this question we've been wondering. Between Virginia and Newfoundland, who is the worst archaeologist?
Yeah. Oh, I keep my opinions to myself. I might have opinions about some stuff, but yeah, I keep, yeah.
I'm curious, Gabe, if this will come out. I believe it was you and Jesse Webb, Gabe, basically quantified that, like, Dave had done about 70% of the faunal analysis or something. And
Jesse figured that out. Yeah.
Yeah. Whether or not the fish data kind of corresponds with this publication, quirk in New Brunswick, basically, that, like, there's like one, you know, David Black basically did the bulk of all this research. And so, you know, all these fish are coming from one research project, basically. So,
yeah. Yeah, in some ways it makes it, you know, ideal if you have fewer analysts, because there's less uncertainty about how people are comparing things or identifying things. Ideally, I'd want, you know, just the entire Eastern North America studied by one person, but we're having to, yeah, deal with that inter-analyst variability. But it's, yeah, it's definitely an interesting experience getting, and there's just not inter-analysts, there's also regional traditions of zoo arc that are variable. So for example, in New York State, they like to call NISP, or number of identified specimens, TNF, total number of fragments.
Oh, that's funny.
And it's just a regional course.
That's great. So I know it's early days somewhat in this research, but what sort of kind of cultural activities, or have you identified any interesting cultural patterns in the data that you could share yet, or is it still too early?
No, we've got some data. We got some interesting results in some of the areas that we're trying to process and interpret right now. So, for example, one of our areas where we do have a quite big coverage is Newfoundland, and we've noticed some interesting patterns in fish use there between settler and indigenous communities. So settlers, unsurprisingly, were very focused on cod, almost at the, essentially, you can get assemblages that are 7,000 bones and 7,000 cod bones and, maybe one bone from another species. Compared to things like ancestral biotech communities where they're harvesting a wide range of species. So that might have implications for why cod collapsed, that we're just so focused on one resource, we didn't sort of distribute the pressure on multiple resources, and it might have been more sustainable to harvest a wider range. And then in areas like Virginia, we're getting a sense that sort of the learning process that settlers at Jamestown and other early settlements were undergoing during the early colonization process. So, for example, early on, it looks like they're fishing a lot of different things, and each site is very different from each other. So it might be this experimental process. They're figuring out what works. And by the 18th century, you sort of get what appears to be almost like a unified regional fishing tradition. Huh. That's sort of...
You're starting to see their palate emerge.
Yeah, their palate or sort of a local, local cuisine. That's what I would suggest. It's like an emergence of a local cuisine where there's rules about what fish are good, what aren't. And it's sort of this emergence of this locally adapted pattern. Yeah, so that's some of the stuff that's emerging. We're hoping once we get plug in more of the data that it's see some of the other patterns and get some more insights into New Brunswick and the rest of the Maritimes. So yeah, but it's coming along, and we're getting some interesting results, and hope to be able to share them in the future.
What the listener doesn't know is that Tom did that answer and didn't break stride while Elwood the cat made his first appearance on the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast.
Yeah, I'm
Gabe disappeared for a second behind a cloud of black fur, basically.
Yeah, I'm used to having a cat around, so I have my own cat.
Elwood wanted to hear more about the fish. He thought this sounded good. It's I don't know if you guys have seen Red Dwarf, but it's like the character of the cat that just keeps hitting the machine and yelling fish. It's like a
really fine grained, there's assemblages where they have it down to the year just based off where they know this person arrived here, and there's his insignia on the top of the well, so we know it was capped and he's only there for a while.
The thing in Maryland is super cool, like being able to see essentially local cuisine evolve. That's really, it must be really fine grained there.
Oh, wow.
Oh, cool. Okay. We're going to ask you that question because I'd love to have that little nuance. Yeah. Okay, the alarms have stopped ringing and Tom's back. And Tom, we were chatting that the patterning that you're seeing in these Maryland historic sites at, this local cuisine kind of evolving is really fine grained. So how is it that you can see these sorts of patterns at such a micro scale in that kind of archaeology?
Yeah. So the Maryland and Virginia, the Chesapeake as a whole, has a really fine chronology. It's, I think the median date range for the assemblages are about 30 years. So it's very well confined. So we're able to really narrow down and see how these stuff change over time. So we're not dealing with, thousands of years or hundreds of years timescales. A lot of it is due to the fact that you have historical records telling you when sites were occupied and there's a well-established ceramic seriation. But the other thing is often you get personal items that have names that are known to be associated with a particular person. and you know exactly when they're at the site. So example, there's a well at Jamestown, and it has a item from an item with that has this artwork that we know is insignia that we know is associated with Lord Delaware, who came to the colony in 1610, and that ordered the fort to be cleaned up after a period of hardship, the starvation time there. So they're able to date the well there right to 1610 because they know that's when he was at the site. At another site, for example, there was a wine bottle where there was the wax seal of the occupant of the site.
Neat.
So we know exactly who that deposit was associated with it and from his wine bottle with the preserved wax seal. So sometimes you get these personal items, and based off the historic record, we know exactly when these people were sort of at the site.
It's incredible that a guy named Lord Delaware landed in Delaware. That's
So in addition to the cultural stuff, Tom, I'm guessing that there's probably some interesting climate change information in the data you're seeing. Are you working on that at all too?
On that as well. We just haven't many results yet that we're testing out. So we do have, we are, for each of the fish species we identify, we're recording sort of ecological information about them. So salinity, are they freshwater fish, marine water fish, brackish, and also things about like their preferred temperature. So does this fish like really warm water, or is it a sub really warm tropical waters, or is it more like a subarctic fish, a cold water adapted fish? And by looking at what we're hoping is by sort of looking at the changes in the abundance of cold versus warm water fish, we can sort of get at those past shifts in water temperature. So the data isn't there yet because some areas are still yet to be collected for still awaiting some data, but
cool.
And then
I imagine when that comes along, there might even be some lessons in there for contemporary people and fisheries amid the climate crisis.
Yeah, that's what we're hoping. Be able to sort of see how fish respond in the past these climatic events to get sort of insights of how they're going to do it in the future.
I thought maybe we could close off, and this is just because it could be Shark Week here on the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast. But on the West Coast, you've done some work that you've called, I think, Sharkeology, using DNA on shark remains to better understand how the Chinese diaspora community fished for sharks.
Yes.
So not usually the coast we talk about on this program, but I thought this was such an interesting project, and I wondered if you could summarize it for us and tell us a little bit about Sharkeology.
Yeah, we might have, for that project, we might have actually started at the title for the project and worked backwards, just because I think we all want it to have a paper called Sharkeology, awesome. Just because it's catchy and grabs attention, especially for, I've done some public talks out in Vancouver, departmental talks, and that's always gets some butts in the seats, is the title Sharkeology. But for that project, we're trying to, during the 19th century, there's a large number of Chinese people that settled in California, Washington, Oregon, British Columbia. And there's often a stereotype that the Chinese communities in the areas were just gold miners or railroad workers. The communities were a lot more diverse. And one of the activities that in California especially was fishing. So at the site we're investigating is Point Alones, which is in Pacific Grove, California, just outside of the current day city of Monterey. And that it was a fishing village from the 1850s to about 1906, and it was occupied mainly by individuals of Chinese descent. The site, as it was a fishing village, you can imagine there was a pile of fish bones and processing waste. And a lot of the fish bones are among the fish bones recovered at the site, not by me, but some grad students at Berkeley or Stanford, were a bunch of shark remains, a bunch of shark vertebrae. So shark vertebrae are notoriously hard to identify. They're very similar morphologically. So as a result, when people identify them morphologically, they are often not telling you what species are, but rather that they're just a shark, or are just telling you what family of shark it is. For example, a broad family like Trichidae, which in areas of California includes multiple species. So for that project, I conducted DNA analysis on a bunch of shark remains from the site just to get a sense of what sharks that this Chinese community was targeting. And our results suggest there's a fairly specialized fishery for tope shark. And based off the historical record, it looks like it was mainly being harvested for its fins, and with the fins being exported to China. So you're starting to get this emergence of this globalized subsistence systems where people are harvesting in one side of the world and exporting the product across the ocean. So the emergence sort of at process, which is called ecological globalization, where you go from the subsistence and ecosystem impacts are going from the local now to a more global scale. But I should note, while they were exporting the fins, they were consuming the whole fish because we get the vertebrae at the site. So they weren't what people often frown upon. The practice today is finning, where the shark fins removed and the carcass dumped in the ocean. But the whole fish was being landed. We have some cool photos of people processing the site with fins. But yeah, so that was it was an interesting project. We have my colleague Ryan Kendi has some other stuff that we're trying to get ready for publication now, looking at other aspects of the fishery there. So what other fish people were taking, and how also sort of a similar process, what we see on the East Coast of early English colonists adapting to a new landscape, how the Chinese diaspora was adapting their fishing practices to their new home. So for example, in the case of the shark, tope shark aren't present in Asia. The product shark fins are, so they were localizing the production of this product that has a 1,000-year-old history using new fish that they had come across in California. So adapting their cultural traditions to their new ecological realities.
Interesting. So I guess, and this would be a total naivete on what you would see in would you see the fins in an archaeological site in California or in China, or would they, because there's no bony elements in them, they wouldn't preserve or anything?
Yeah, no, sharks, unlike most other fish, they're not, they're what we call cartilaginous fish, rather than a fish like a salmon or a cod or a herring is a bony fish where they have a bony skeleton. Sharks lack a bony skeleton. So all that really preserves typically an archaeological site is vertebrae that have ossified. So they're not true bones. They're just vertebrae that have slowly mineralized as a result as through aging.
Interesting.
So there is no bones in the fin that you would recover. So it's essentially the back half of the trade is essentially archaeological invisible. So the export product would be archaeologically invisible in China.
Interesting. Very interesting.
So sharks, that makes sharks archaeologically uncommon because they just have so few bones that preserve. It's just really the ossified vertebrae, right, and teeth.
The teeth, of course, being the scary part of the shark. Yeah.
Yeah, the cool part, though. And out east in our database, we certainly have lots of instances of shark teeth appearing just because of their cultural symbolic importance in the Maritimes and to indigenous peoples throughout sort of Eastern North America as a touchdown.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Tom. This is fascinating research, and I'm looking forward to seeing what comes of it.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. This is pretty cool. It's very complimentary to a talk we had with a woman last year about using archaeological data sets to track the extinction of the great auk. So we'll package this up in maybe our bioarchaeological investigation.
We'll get sharks and auks.
Yeah. I guess if you're from Boston, I guess. That's my
Well, thanks very much, Tom.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
All right, Gabe, that was an interesting interview, and I think it is time for Hit Pieces.
I think it is. And Ken, I think we've got, we're changing gears a little bit here, and we've got our mutual friend Amy Fox recently appeared on episode 4 of the TA Table, that's TA as in Teaching Assistant, to give a short, I think it's, maybe 12 minutes, discussion about decolonizing learning environments as a teaching assistant. And in that
talking about just kind of some tips and tricks to can use to try to make a more accessible learning environment and one in which is sensitive to various kinds of colonial concerns.
Yeah, yeah. So among them, she talks about like what is a land acknowledgement? Why do we do it? And what are some of the ways that you can make a land acknowledgement more active rather than just kind of a static perfunctory statement? And talking about sort of being a little bit more self-aware about the setting where you're in and the people who you're working with and the kinds of data and sort of information that you're conveying to students.
That's right. She also recommends an interesting book in that presentation called Elements of Indigenous Style, which is worth worth picking up for anyone who's doing writing in anthropology. So Harry, I encourage you to check that out, probably especially if you're a TA yourself or a faculty member. I think it would be worth listening to and getting that perspective and thinking about how you can use those things, not just as a kind of, I think what she sort of gets at in that is that sometimes it's tempting to just sort of have a pro forma land acknowledgement when you can actually use them for more productive teaching and reflection.
Yeah, exactly. And kind of how to integrate that in the classroom. And I think it's applicable in this case to teaching assistants, but I think in general, it's probably applicable to anybody who is teaching people and who are engaging with and teaching about Indigenous people and Indigenous pasts and in particular, people who are non-Indigenous researchers working with these kinds of data.
That's right. And Ken, I think that's our episode for today. We'll go home and have some tinned fish and reflect on the Four Oceans Project and see the listener, talk to the listener, I guess, in a fortnight.
Yep, and we'll see you again in a fortnight, listener. And as we said before, always happy to hear from you. So at @new_Brunswick_archaeology on Instagram, newbrunswickarchaeology.com, and you can always email us at newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. Talk to you soon, listener.
Talk to you soon. We'll be right back.